Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. On today's show, we welcome back New York Times global economics correspondent Peter Goodman to continue our conversation about his new book, Davos Man, How the Billionaires Devoured the World. Peter Goodman writes about some of the world's most prominent billionaires, documents the plight of their victims, and describes how ordinary citizens can fight back. Peter Goodman has spent decades studying what he calls one of the world's most dangerous species, the billionaires who over the past 50 years have systematically looted the world's economies, starved societies of tax revenues needed to maintain essential services, profited massively during the pandemic, prolonged the pandemic, and destabilized democracy, all while portraying themselves as concerned global citizens who are creating a more socially conscious form of capitalism. Peter Goodman is a global economics correspondent for the New York Times. As the Times national economic correspondent, he played a leading role in the paper's award-winning coverage of the Great Recession, including a series that was a Pulitzer Prize finalist. Hi, Peter. Thanks so much for joining us again.
Hey, Rose. Thanks for having me back.
Well, it's great to have you back. Peter, I track you on Twitter, and you've done a lot of interviews about this book. So again, congratulations. It's really important. And I just wonder, what has really stood out for you when you talk with people about how to really tackle this crisis?
I mean, I think there's a sense of hopelessness that we have to push against. I think that there are so many ways in which seeming to be aware of what's happening and wanting to be seen as sophisticated amounts to a kind of cynicism, a feeling of just being beleaguered in the face of the reality that the billionaire class and corporate interests in general have managed to take their winnings and apply them through very adept lobbying campaigns that are now sharpened with social media, public relations professionals, to essentially insulate themselves from accountability and to rig the system so that democracy no longer, not to imagine some previous time when democracy worked perfectly or wonderfully, but you know, to a place where democracy is really threatened, where the popular will is frequently undermined by some interest group that's adept at pulling the levers. And I think people are aware and they need a sense of hope. And the only place we can begin with hope is to at least understand how the game works and to understand the consequences of allowing such a small group of people to amass such unchecked power.
This is such a good point, and it's reminding me of an interview we did a couple weeks ago with Rakeen Mahboud, who's with the Groundwork Collaborative, and they have been monitoring all of these investor calls, and they're hearing CEOs of major corporations bragging about raising prices while bringing in record profits. One of the examples I think is so important is Procter & Gamble owns just about every diaper company in the country. And so families really have nowhere else to go. And they're raising prices on diapers. And we were just talking about how things have changed so much where, you know, back in the day, you could boycott a specific company and really make a difference. But now things are so globalized and boycotts don't work as well, or they've got to be done in a different way. And I just wonder what your thoughts are about grassroots movements, people protesting. I mean, just given how the economy has changed so drastically, how do you think people creating change need to change their tactics?
Well, first of all, now we're verging into my next book, which I'm already working on this supply chain disruption. And I think you know, your point about Procter & Gamble and diapers, it has less to do with globalization and more to do with monopoly power. I mean, the thesis of my next book is that beneath a lot of these shortages that are, you know, caused most immediately by the pandemic and disruption to global trade is the reality that many markets are concentrated. There are fewer and fewer players. There just isn't much competition. There aren't many alternatives. So if you don't like the price of diapers, good luck finding somebody who's going to undercut, you know, whatever's available. Now, in terms of, you know, grassroots campaigns, consumer power is very powerful. It's very potent when it's mobilized. But it's true that companies that are making stuff are assembling goods from around the world and often don't even know themselves. This is something I've learned through my own supply chain reporting over the years. They don't often know themselves who their own sub-suppliers are. So, you know, the take the apparel companies, which after decades of being exposed to reported incidents of relying on child labor or, you know, terrible sweatshop conditions with people dying in fires in countries like Bangladesh, you know, have spent money doing audits on their own supply chains to understand where they're buying their goods. But what they discover again and again is, okay, you know, if you are a large apparel company, you can ensure that you're getting fabric from a company that is doing reasonably reputable business, that's complying with environmental and workplace standards. But you don't know where the thread comes from. The thread, there's a good chance, you know, draws on cotton that's harvested in Xinjiang, the region of China where the Uyghurs live. And the Chinese government stands accused of genocide in what it considers Xinjiang province. And it's almost impossible to know with confidence if you're in the apparel business that you've rooted out threads of cotton harvested in Xinjiang because it's such a huge player. That's just one example of how complex the supply chain is. That said, when consumers do rise up and when they do identify targets that are guilty of profiteering, that are guilty of exploiting monopoly power, or, you know, in very extreme cases, relying on enslaved labor or child labor, they do tend to be more sensitive to that than ever because social media is now such a force. So I don't think people have to lose hope, but we have to be more creative and we have to be more knowledgeable about the world that we're living in.
And what your book really looks at and explores is how the billionaire class, you know, over decades have affected the system, have changed laws. And as you write, they've squashed the power of labor movements, shrinking paychecks, handing the savings of their shareholders. Can you just talk about what you think is most important or what really caught your attention the most when it comes to learning about how this all happened?
Well, some of this was just putting together things that I've been thinking about and writing about for years and years. You know, I think there's been this tendency over the, you know, now three decades that I've been writing about international trade to pick a side on China. And so, you know, for much of my career, I was in a position where I would kind of blow the whistle on, and I do this in my book to an extent. You know, if your position is that American middle class standards have been downgraded and it's China's fault, I think you're barking up the wrong tree. That is not to say that China is not a serious threat to living standards, because China does pose a real challenge to the global trading system and breaches global trading norms. And, you know, we just discussed the Uyghurs. I mean, we're talking about a potential source of slave labor. China is a problem that has to be addressed. But the idea that we have to take the fight to Beijing in order to save the American middle class, that's what's wrong. Because it's not an accident that huge numbers of American multinationals have found their way to China to make goods on terms that are very sweet for them and that undercut labor standards back in the United States. That did not happen by accident. It happened through very aggressive, very sophisticated, very effective lobbying by the people I call Davos Man in my book, the billionaire class, people who are running large multinational corporations, understood that if they could simply establish the credible threat of moving production to countries like China, they could force labor unions at home to make big concessions on wages. They could get all sorts of flexibility and scheduling. They could figure out how to save costs and send more money through dividends and share buybacks to the shareholder class. So it's not that China isn't a threat. Of course, China's a threat. But the threat comes not from decisions made in Beijing, but decisions made in boardrooms in Seattle and in New York and in Congress. And we live through, you know, I tell the story of the cosmic lie in the book, you know, this idea that we've discussed previously, that if you just organize your economies around sending more wealth to the people who already have more of it, somehow the benefits will just trickle down broadly. Well, a subset of the cosmic lie was, you know, well, we're not letting China into the global trading system for simple reasons of profit. This is about liberating Chinese middle class people. This is about democratizing China. We heard this from Bill Clinton. We heard this from Larry Summers. We heard this from many, many CEOs of major corporations, including Hank Paulson, who's the Treasury Secretary under George W. Bush. We were supposedly going to democratize China through trade, a project that has, of course, failed. And the one part that hasn't failed is the permanent hit to wage standards, workplace conditions in the United States, as a result of shifting so much production to China without workplace protections.
This is so important because all of this hawkish talk about China and pointing fingers at China takes the blame from what these politicians have done, exactly what you're talking about. And just to read a bit from your book, the year after China joined the WTO, Walmart moved its global procurement center to the Chinese boomtown of Shenzhen, relying on surrounding factories to fill its stores with thousands of items. As Walmart sales grew, its stock price soared, turning its founders, the Walton family, into the richest clan in the United States. Many major American automakers would eventually sell more cars in China than the United States. The bulk of the world's apparel industry steadily concentrated its operations in China. And then Jeff Bezos's fortune multiplied as Amazon stock gained value, in part because of the company's success in tapping Chinese factories for low-priced goods. So as you say, Peter, when we hear either Republicans or President Biden talking about China, they don't focus on these issues that you address in your book.
I mean, where did the investment come from? I mean, essentially, we took investment that used to be in the United States in American plants, American innovation, hiring American workers, and we moved it to China as a way to get out from under having to comply with environmental standards, wage standards, workplace safety standards. And the winners have been, to an extent, American consumers. There's no question that we're paying less for shoes and t-shirts and tube socks and kitchenware than we were previously. That has really happened. But in large part, we've needed those lower cost goods because so many of our jobs have been downgraded by shifting production elsewhere where there are no unions. I mean, that's the great irony, right? People's Republic of China, supposedly, you know, this sentinel to labor interests. I mean, this the product of a people's uprising and engages in this massive kind of joint venture with Walmart and then eventually Amazon, then the largest retailer. I remember, you know, back when I was working for the Washington Post in, I think it was 2002, 2003, and I was based in China, and I took a trip to that Shenzhen procurement center, and it was really an incredible experience. This is the kind of access that's very difficult to get now in China. I spent a day just hanging out in the procurement center, and you could see that Walmart had these mostly American buyers sitting in these conference rooms. And then there were all of these representatives of local factories from throughout Guangdong province in southern China. And they'd be sitting in these uncomfortable chairs, like the kind of chairs that we would sit in elementary school with the little, writing desk attached to the chair. And they'd be served these kind of tepid cups of tea in plastic cups. And they'd sit there for hours. And then one of them would get called in, you know, like say Walmart was buying Christmas decorations, and the buyer would go out and find a representative from a factory. They'd bring him in. And if they didn't like the price, that representative for the local factory knew that the Walmart buyer could just go right back out into the waiting hall where they'd spent hours and just go find somebody else from another factory who would give them the price. And then frequently Walmart would agree to terms on price, and often they would engage, you know, three or four different factories for one order of goods. And then midstream, this story I heard again and again, you know, Walmart would say to the factory, hey, actually, we have to renegotiate the price. Oh, you don't like the lower price? Well, sorry that you're on the hook for materials and workers. It's a take it or leave it proposition. So, you know, we're used to thinking of China as being the bad actor in the global economy. And there's plenty of material to burnish that argument. But, you know, here's an example of Walmart, then the world's largest retailer, representing Walmart's corporate shareholders. I mean, this is Davos, man, essentially dictating the terms. And China's just an instrument in the toolkit being used to squeeze working people in China and in the United States while transferring the proceeds to themselves, the shareholder.
And taking the factories to a country like China, because they can pay very low wages, they don't have to abide by any environmental or labor laws. And it's just so important as we're talking about this, Peter. I was thinking about the group ChinaLaborWatch.org, where they basically do these investigations. There's one right now. China Labor Watch urges Amazon to address whistleblowers' demands. Tang Mengfang exposed Foxconn factory's illegal use of student workers on an Amazon production line. He exposed how the student workers were coerced to perform overtime shifts under verbal threats. And then there's another one about abuse in the printing supply chain, an investigation into two cartridge manufacturers. So it's also important to highlight the fact that so many of these workers are being exploited by these multinationals to then ship cheap stuff back to Europe and the United States.
Yeah, that's right. And who's the beneficiary? I mean, most of the time now, given that we're in this new sort of Cold War mentality, and I'm, by the way, I mean, let me take note. I am not excusing Beijing for systematic human rights violations and military adventurism and a very muscular foreign policy that's highly problematic. This is not to excuse Beijing, but the point is we exclusively now hear in much reporting out of China about China as just this threat intent on global domination. When these examples that you're highlighting, these are Chinese workers being exploited for the benefit of the American shareholder class. And the American shareholder class then says, yeah, well, you know, we're serving the interests of consumers. But again, consumers need these low prices because wages in the U.S. have been downgraded in part because of the threat and actual practice of work being shifted to low-wage places where there are no unions, where there are no workplace safety standards, or at least not enforced. And that's a dynamic that we really have to understand rather than trading in these simplistic notions of, you know, which countries are good and which are bad.
Right. And these CEOs wearing their flag lapel pins.
Right. Right? Yeah, exactly. As yeah. if all of our interests are the same. I mean, this is the ultimate thing that I'm trying to take on in my book. Our interests are not the same. And the idea that Jeff Bezos's interests or the interests of Steve Schwarzman, who's the world's largest private equity magnate, who's worth, depending upon which day you look, you know, somewhere around $35 billion, who has large investments in China, the idea that their interests are the same as the worker at a GM plant in Ohio or a white collar professional who's worried about their job in California being shipped overseas. It's just absurd. But that flag label pin is part of trying to ensure that we see ourselves as all being on the same team. Mm-hmm. And if we see ourselves as, you know, US versus China writ large, we're masking all of the class differences that are vital to understand if we want to make sense of what's really happening. And what's happening is the shareholder in China and the United States, the wealthy people in China and the United States are contriving to figure out how to get more of the wealth and put it in their own pocket at everybody else's expense.
Today, we are speaking with Peter Goodman, global economics correspondent for the New York Times, about his book, Davos Man, How the Billionaires Devoured the World. Peter Goodman writes about some of the world's most prominent billionaires. He documents the plight of their victims and describes how ordinary citizens can fight back. If you have any questions or comments for Peter about the billionaires and how they got to this place, what we can do to tackle massive, massive inequality in this country, and really around the world, you can give us a call at 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org or tweet at yourcallradio. Let's hear from a caller. Let's go to Eid in Berkeley. Hi, Eid. Welcome to the show.
Good morning. You know, I've been talking to you for so many years about this whole topic. Your guest is right on. right on. And the fact is, right now, this economy is not sustainable at all. This is big belief, voodoo economics from Reagan time. So I send you an article I wrote about 1995, published in Daily Cal and Daily California and Daily Planet in Berkeley for many years. Nobody paid attention. This voodoo economic of Reagan, he totally destroyed this country, shipped jobs overseas, shut factories, and right now we are borrowed, we're living in borrowed time as far as what this economy goes for. By the way, you know, remember, in 19, before Reagan took office as a president, 96% of the American GDP was industrial, manufacturing. Only 4% was industrial. Now, you know, everything is made in China, and that thing really it states exactly how this happened. When Reagan sent tens of millions of jobs, closed the biggest company, electronic company in the whole country, RCA, Zenith, Panasonic, destroyed my country. In fact, I filed a lawsuit in federal court in San Francisco to stop that, and Reagan betrayed me. And he allowed vertical price fixing, which cost my company millions. The last thing I'd like to say, because I'm taking too much time, is it is not sustainable. What's happening right now is not sustainable. The only solution, because a lot of this wealth was accumulated by illegal, illicit, and all kind of things for the Wall Street, which is nothing but a casino for these billionaires. Mm-hmm. What we need to do to fix the economy, short of that the country is going down the drain, is ceiling in wealth. Ceiling in wealth. We're talking about Russia war. We're talking about China war. What happened if we have a war with China? What are we going to get all other things? You know, the last part of my article, it said, you know, you don't care about your neighbor lose his job, but you have to worry about the next job you lose is yours.
Right.
Millions of jobs. Never mind big companies like Apple, Microsoft, all of this using slave labor in China. An iPhone that costs you $1,000, Apple paid $25 for it for poor Chinese slaves. Many of them commit suicide.
Well, thank you, Ed, and thank you for the call. And that you're so right. We did shows about that. What happened at Foxconn? Just one stat you bring out in your book related to Ed's question, Peter. Between 1999 and 2011, the shock inflicted by Chinese imports eliminated nearly 1 million American manufacturing jobs and roughly twice that number if you consider the ripple effect. When you think about the restaurants and everything else that was affected by the factories shutting down, the truck drivers not needed, the carpenters who lost their jobs. And Ed's right. I mean, you even interviewed a lot of these people who lost their jobs because of this.
Yeah, I mean, the ripple effects of the loss of manufacturing jobs have been enormous. You know, this question about whether this is sustainable, who knows? But I think we can say this. Democracy is not sustainable under these circumstances. I mean, can we continue to run economies where a handful of people get most of the benefits and everybody else gets scraps? History does not suggest that that's sustainable forever, though we're living, again, in a time of tremendous surveillance, social media, the ability to misdirect. There are all sorts of political opportunists. I mean, this is what my book's really about, who jump into circumstances of scarcity and figure out how to demonize someone, usually immigrants, or they gin up social issues as a kind of diversion from the economic reality. And that seems to be working especially well in our current circumstances. But democracy doesn't seem to be sustainable. I mean, how do you have a debate about something really important, crucial, existential, like climate change, if everyone understands that the people at the top are not sacrificing? How are they supposed to sacrifice? How do we ask a coal miner in West Virginia to give up their livelihood and find something else to do if they can see that, you know, we're not taxing wealthy people, we're not investing in job training, we're not investing in infrastructure? They understand in their bones that if they fail, they're on their own. So it's very difficult to see how we can sustain democracy if we don't figure out how to get the benefits of our capitalism distributed to more people.
We brought this up on a past show you were on, but I think it's worth repeating because there are solutions out there. As you point out, when you're talking about coal miners in Scandinavian countries, they're harmed by trade also, just like every other country. But the state trains workers for new careers when they lose their jobs while helping them pay their bills when they're out of work. And so they know, yes, the life changes, things have to change, but there's going to be help for us. That's just not the case here in the U.S.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up. Yeah, you're remembering this visit I took to a coal mining operation in Sweden, where employees knew that the truck drivers were going to be replaced eventually by self-driving vehicles. And I was really struck as I talked to people at that mining operation, you know, as an American, expecting that there'd be tremendous resistance and knowing, you know, that around the world, automation tends to raise the hackles of labor unions, that everyone I talked to in this mine said, yeah, we're fine with that. We don't worry about that at all, because we understand that automation is going to make the company more productive. And if the company is more productive, wages will go up for everyone. And if we lose our job, well, there'll be some other job for us, or we'll get trained for another job. And this was not some sort of utopian fantasy. This was a conclusion they'd arrived at based on their lived experience. I mean, they were living in a country where taxes on wealthy people are much higher than in the U.S., where there are real social safety nets. Healthcare is available to everybody. University education, well, education straight on through is universally accessible to all. Famously, I think most Americans know this. You know, if you have a baby in Sweden, the parents get 500 days of parental leave to distribute however they like between both parents. I mean, there is a lived experience that says, if something goes awry, if I lose my job, I'll have unemployment, I'll have help with my housing, I can get trained for something else. And the result of that is there's actually more entrepreneurialism. And I think, you know, for anybody who's connected to Silicon Valley, who likes to think of the U.S. as the great risk-taking place, creative destruction in contrast to the nanny state socialism of the Nordics and other parts of Europe, it bears noting that there in Sweden, a social safety net, which entails higher taxation on wealthy people, amounts to more entrepreneurialism. I mean, how many Americans are stuck in jobs that they know are dead ends, that they don't engage their passions at all, simply because they're hanging on to their healthcare? How many people who are engaged in things like coal mining, who get that, you know, there shouldn't be demand for what they're producing, but it's how they make their living, would maybe go train to do something else, maybe move to a faster growing part of the country if there was some help available? But it's that lack of help. And that lack of help is a direct result of the fact that we don't tax wealthy people, while buying this argument from Davos Man, disseminated through compliant think tanks and access journalists and lobbying campaigns, that, you know, in the U.S., we either have the status quo with lots of inequality, but the miracles of technological innovation, COVID vaccines, or we monkey around with that magic formula and we turn into Venezuela. You know, that mentality is so deep in our political discourse that I think we're often blinded to this reality that more opportunities come from an expanded social safety net, and that comes from taxing rich people.
Hmm. Well, we're going to take a quick break, and then we will talk about how the tax system has changed and what it will take to tax the wealthy. We're joined today by Peter Goodman, global economics correspondent for the New York Times, and we're discussing his book, Davos Man, How the Billionaires Devoured the World. This is Your Call. We'll be back after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Today we are speaking with Peter Goodman, New York Times global economics correspondent and author of Davos Man, How the Billionaires Devoured the World. Peter Goodman writes about some of the world's most prominent billionaires, documents the plight of their victims, and describes how ordinary citizens can fight back. And if you have any questions or comments about where we are right now, the tax system, massive inequality, money in politics, what we can do to change all of this, we'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org or tweet us. We're at Your Call Radio. Peter, let's talk a little bit about taxes. When we've had you on before, we brought up this statistic because it bears repeating, like so many of the facts in your book. A pair of UC Berkeley economists who've been on the show, Emmanuel Saez and Gabriel Zuckman, tallied up all the taxes that Americans paid, from federal, state, and local income taxes to sales taxes and capital gains on investments. and they concluded that the richest 400 Americans, whose average wealth was almost $7 billion, have seen their effective tax rate cut by more than half since 1962, from 54% to 23%. So give us some context. How did that happen, and what does that mean in practice?
Well, the short answer is it didn't happen by accident. It happened through careful lobbying on multiple fronts. The context is tax rates were lowered. All sorts of income was moved to other parts of the ledger. So, you know, people like Steve Schwarzman, who's in private equity, manages to treat much of his income, what the rest of us will call income, you know, money that comes his way that he can do with what he likes because it's his money. Instead of it being income and taxed at the same income tax rates that most of us pay, it gets turned into, you know, partnership distributions or other kinds of income taxed at much lower rates, often half the rates of normal tax rates. And tax rates themselves have come down dramatically. I mean, at the high end, back in the 60s, where, you know, we had tax rates still well above 70 into 80% on the highest earners, got dropped down into the 30s, you know, during the Reagan administration, and have stayed there with some bouncing around ever since. Corporate taxes have been lowered. Trump's huge collection of tax cuts worth $1.5 trillion lavished primarily on the people I write about in my book, Davos Man, the billionaire class. That included a big reduction in corporate income taxes. And of course, who benefits from that? People who own most of the shares. So, you know, this has been a slow motion but continual process of change that, you know, it's almost like it's invisible, like climate change, where suddenly, you know, you wake up and you haven't been paying attention to the 1 millimeter or fraction thereof, you know, change in the water level in some body of water until suddenly everybody's underwater because there's a big storm. Well, we're living in that big storm right now. That's the pandemic. And it's revealed the consequences of having a government essentially downgraded, left with few resources at the same time that so much of our economy is built around rescuing the asset class. And so, you know, the result of that, the people I've written about in my book and lots of other billionaires who could have been in my book but aren't, have seen their fortunes roughly double while most of humanity has suffered.
It's also really incredible when you think about just how wealthy people are. And I wonder if, you know, people who aren't listening to the news and reading the news all day, like people who are working 8-hour days and then taking care of kids and maybe have another job and don't really follow all of this closely. I mean, just learning about Bernard Arnault, the chair and CEO of Moet Hennessy Louis Vuitton. I didn't even know that they had merged, the world's largest maker of luxury goods. His company's empire of brands include Christian Dior, Bulgari, and Givenchy, catering to people willing to spend $150,000 on a piece of luggage, had supplied Bernard Arnault with a fortune estimated at more than $100 billion, making him one of the three wealthiest people on the planet.
Closer to $200 billion now.
Wow. So I just, like, people are just, you can't even wrap your head around this kind of money.
Yeah. I mean, these numbers, they're just so fantastic that it's hard to contemplate how much money we're talking about. But we can see what it can achieve. I mean, look at Jeff Bezos, right, who is worth, depending upon which day, somewhere between $150 billion and $200 billion, depending on Amazon's stock price. So, you know, here's someone whose fortune roughly doubles during the pandemic. And while we're all still dealing with kids either in school wearing masks all day or dealing with distance learning, while we're worried about contracting COVID and ending up in the hospital, we're getting our elderly relatives sick, while our work life is disrupted, while we can't go out and visit our friends or see a show or, you know, engage in all sorts of activities that are central to how we take pleasure in our lives. Here's Jeff Bezos shooting himself into space to the tune of $5.5 billion, thanking his workers, I mean, warehouse workers who he deprived of protective gear in the first wave of the pandemic while thanking them Davos man style for their great sacrifice in at least sending these goods that they don't have, hand sanitizer, gloves, face masks, to paying customers. And after my book comes out, I mean, this would have made it into the book if I hadn't wrapped it up by then. We know that Jeff Bezos is talking to the city of Rotterdam. This is the scene of the largest port in Europe in the midst of the supply chain disruption that's still, you know, preventing ventilators from getting places they need to be, that's preventing medical device manufacturers from getting gear they need to make life-saving equipment. Jeff Bezos is talking to the city of Rotterdam, home of Europe's largest port, about removing a bridge that's in the way of his $500 million, 400-foot yacht, made at a shipyard in the Netherlands. And this bridge in Rotterdam is preventing it from getting clear to the ocean. So in the midst of all of this, in the run-up to Russia's invasion of Ukraine, in the middle of the supply chain disruption, there are bureaucrats in Rotterdam talking about how to get this bridge out of Jeff Bezos' way. That's how much money this man has.
Mm. Well, this is one of the Davos men that we have not talked about during the show, because we've done a lot of shows about Amazon, but I think the details you lay out, we should discuss. As you write, and it's probably bigger now, but Jeff Bezos has amassed a personal fortune exceeding $200 billion, a triplex penthouse with two pools on Manhattan's Fifth Avenue, a $165 million mansion in Beverly Hills, the most expensive property ever sold in California, a 27,000 square foot home in DC, a $66 million Gulfstream jet. I mean, it just goes on and on. When you look at the numbers, Peter, during the first half of the year, Amazon sold $164 billion worth of goods, or more than $10,000 worth every single second.
Yeah. So, you know, I'm glad that you've raised this, because, you know, I actually don't think there's a problem with the fact that Bezos is really rich. My book is not about demonizing wealthy people. This is a guy who actually had a vision for e-commerce, who executed on that vision to an exceptional degree, who created something that huge numbers of people find very compelling, very engaging, very convenient. I mean, how would we have endured the pandemic, those of us lucky enough to be able to work from home, without Amazon or other e-commerce offerings? So I don't begrudge the fact that Jeff Bezos has a lot more money than most people, but he ought to pay his taxes. I mean, he ought to pay taxes so that the government can continue to build infrastructure, so that we can have the internet, so that there can be research that produces the sorts of innovations that will catalyze the next wave of technology startups that could give us another kind of Amazon in some other part of life, and so that universities have funds so that they can train the people who are doing the coding that have enabled Bezos to amass this fortune, and so that we have things like paid sick leave so that warehouse workers don't have to choose between their paychecks and keeping the lights on in their own homes, putting groceries on the table at home to feed their children, or going to work and putting their lives on the line because they're working in the middle of a pandemic without any protection. We can have the miracle of e-commerce, and Jeff Bezos can be plenty wealthy, maybe even wealthy enough to own a $500 million yacht and blast himself into space and still pay taxes and behave like a responsible citizen living in society, as opposed to somebody trying to build like the ultimate gated community in some fantastical version of space. And instead, you know, what we saw during the pandemic, I mean, I tell the story of Christian Smalls, who I think is probably a familiar character to many people now. He's the warehouse worker in Staten Island, New York, who led a labor uprising, a walkout, when it became clear that large numbers of people were getting COVID in his warehouse while the managers were all, you know, safely somewhere else. And he was fired for violating quarantine, ironically. And that's ironic because he wanted everyone to be quarantined, though, again, with paid sick leave, something that Amazon has lobbied against strenuously. This is a company with 100 plus lobbyists employed in Washington, D.C., and they've successfully prevented federal policies on paid sick leave. And thanks to Vice News, we know that after the Smalls story becomes a public relations fiasco for Amazon, the general counsel of Amazon, a guy named David Zapolsky, meets with Bezos and other executives, and they decide in dealing with Smalls. Smalls is an African-American guy born and raised in Newark, New Jersey, who has spent, as he tells me, most of his life working in mostly black workforces for predominantly white managers who in many cases, treat them, as he said, like we're in the cotton fields picking cotton. And this is just the latest example of that, where most of his fellow workers are Latino, they're Asian, they're African-American. Most of the managers are white and they're off the premises. And now Zapolsky, the Ivy League educated general counsel for Amazon, raised, as it happens, in a posh New York suburb not far from Newark, New Jersey, says to Bezos, well, let's train the lens on this guy, Christian Smalls, because he is not articulate or smart. And to the extent to which we can associate him with this labor movement, will benefit. And Bezos apparently goes on with this, and that's what they do. When I call Amazon later to ask them about this, oh, and I should tell you, Zapolsky, of course, has a picture of John Lewis and a tribute to John Lewis on his Facebook timeline. I'm told by an Amazon PR person that Mr. Zapolsky regrets these comments, but was not aware of Mr. Smalls' race at the time that he made them. Wow. So, this underscores that it's not simply that Bezos is making all this money and his warehouse workers are suffering. It's that Bezos is making all this money because his warehouse workers are suffering. And that is a problem.
Right. And you report Christian Smalls has three kids, so he's got a family to provide for.
Right. That's right.
And then also, because the pay is so low in many states, Amazon workers qualify for food stamps, which is the case for so many of these massive corporations.
I mean, we're subsidizing this. And again, our conversation comes full circle because Amazon, when they're confronted with, now an antitrust case that's being amassed by the FTC, what they say again and again is what every Davos man says. I work for you. I serve you, the consumer, as if there's a person out there who's not a laborer, who's not a citizen, who's just purely a consumer. That's this fantasy person that the policy is sold on benefiting. And to your point, Christian Smalls, he's a consumer like the rest of us, but he's also a dad who's got to feed his kids. And there are lots of Amazon workers who are dependent upon our taxes to just ensure that they can give their kids their basic caloric intake thanks to food stamps. This is a subsidy that we're making in exchange for the consumer benefit of whatever cheap stuff we can have delivered to our door by Amazon. We're paying taxes to make sure that the workforce can simply get fed.
Peter, we're getting a lot of emails about what can be done about this, and we have about three or so more minutes. And just to let people know what's going on right now, the group Patriotic Millionaires, this is a group of very wealthy people, they just wrote a letter that says, the truth is that Davos does not deserve the world's trust right now. You've got to tax us, tax the wealthy. It's taxes or pitchforks, they wrote. And then in California, a handful of Democrats are trying to pass a wealth tax that would raise taxes on households worth $50 million. So there's things, bills out there. There's the PRO Act that would ensure that people could unionize. But what are your thoughts? Like, what are you looking at right now that would actually start to change this system?
Well, I think the wealth tax is very powerful and very important. And actually, Saez and Zucman, whose work you quite rightfully goes right at this. I mean, Davos man, the billionaire class, has excelled at making sure that his wealth comes in the form in which it will not be taxed. And in the States, we generally tax income. No, we do have some wealth taxes. We have very regressive forms of wealth taxes. Those of us who own homes are paying a kind of wealth tax, but that hits the middle class and the upper middle class and doesn't hit the wealthy nearly as hard because most of their wealth is tied up in other things that most of us don't own in quantities that exceed the value of our house. For most of us, our house is the biggest asset that we own if we own a house. Whereas, you know, Jeff Bezos, his assets are tied up in Amazon stock. And unless he sells his Amazon stock, he doesn't pay any tax at all. And if he does sell his stock, he then pays capital gains taxes, which thanks to his lobbyists over time are well below income taxes. Jeff Bezos earns on paper about $83,000 a year. That's a salary from Amazon. That's about what an elementary public school teacher makes in California. So if we simply depend on income taxes, and Davos Man has got all sorts of arguments on why we have to. I mean, Jamie Dimon, who's another main character in my book, he's the CEO of America's largest bank, JP Morgan Chase, he would say, oh, it's somehow impossible to levy a wealth tax because how do we value, you know, modern art and wine cellars? And, you know, I think there are people at JP Morgan Chase and other financial institutions who would tell you, if the subject was a different context, that they could figure out how to value modern art or pretty much anything. So a wealth tax we need because that's where the money is.
And okay, so it's March. The elections are in November. What are you hearing in DC about what it would take to pass a wealth tax?
Well, you know, this is where the cynical members of my journalistic tribe always say, you know, everything you're saying, no one wants it. You know, no one wants it because every time this stuff comes up for a vote, it gets voted down as if the political process that we have is somehow an organic reflection of the popular will. It is true that the wealth tax does not have political support in Washington, D.C. That's not because, you know, Americans have all looked into this so carefully and concluded that on the merits they don't want a wealth tax. It's because, again, companies like Amazon employ lobbyists by the hundred because the financial services industry employs lobbyists, you know, by the thousands. And basically Davos Man doesn't want to pay. So Davos Man will convene seminars at compliant think tanks. We'll get the word out through favored access journalists that this stuff is impossible. And so our political discourse is tainted by this absurd notion that the United States is somehow, you know, not capable of administering a tax on wealth, which is just a way of reinforcing the status quo in which people like Jeff Bezos, Steve Schwarzman, Mark Benioff are handing over a much smaller share of their income to state and federal governments than the people who are scrubbing their toilets.
Mm. Well, that is why your book is so important, Peter. Peter Goodman is author of Davos Man, How the Billionaires Devoured the World. Peter is New York Times global economics correspondent. Once again, Peter, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Rose. Really appreciate it.
Thank you. And thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call.